It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up in a few minutes, after House Majority Leader Eric Cantor's primary defeat at the hands of an opponent with Tea Party support, we'll look back at the history of populism in the United States with our resident Central Time historian. First, we continue our WPR news series looking at Governor Scott Walker's campaign promises and how they've panned out.
When Scott Walker ran for governor in 2010, he had a message for voters about the size of the government he wanted to run. Smaller, Walker said, was better. Walker felt so strongly about smaller government that he included it as part of his oft-repeated brown bag promise on the campaign trail. In our continuing series on Walker's promises by the numbers, Sean Johnson reports on whether the governor lived up to his goal.
To fully appreciate Walker's smaller government is better government pledge, you have to remember when he made it. In 2010, many voters were frustrated with government. Republican voters were mad at government. Conservatives attacked government at Tea Party rallies like one in Madison, where a guy dressed up as Thomas Jefferson and told the crowd that they were slaves.
This government is claiming to be all-powerful, and you are its slaves. Are you ready to give up liberty like this?
No!
Even Walker, who's normally reserved, was piling on in speeches like this one at the Republican Party state convention.
We're going to take all those big government liberals and load them up on a train and run them right out of town.
The smaller government pledge clearly worked for Walker in 2010. The question 4 years later is, did government get smaller? Responses were all over the place at a recent Dane County farmers market. Ernie Pearson of Baraboo says he likes the idea of smaller government, and broadly speaking, he thinks the governor achieved it.
I've worked in the private sector my whole life, and to be competitive, you have to run fairly lean, and I think that our government needs to operate in the same way.
Jeff Bybee of Middleton is unimpressed. He says the term smaller government is completely relative.
That's not measurable. And so, again, you're back to a rhetorical argument that's just basically trying to evoke an emotional response. Yes, we need smaller government. Everybody can relate to that, whatever the heck that means.
Indeed, people who research the budget for a living say the same thing.
Yeah, frankly, I don't know how you measure it. That's a totally subjective statement.
John Peacock is the director of the Budget Project at the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. He says one way you can measure government is to look at the budgets the governor has introduced and compare them to overall personal income in Wisconsin.
And by that measure, we are spending a little bit less than we were a few years ago.
Todd Berry with the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance says it's not really the state that's gotten smaller.
It's probably fair to say that local government has been more on hold in terms of size than state government.
Take school districts. Revenue limits signed by Walker forced schools to reduce property taxes a couple years ago, and they allowed a modest increase this year. Ken Bates, the superintendent for the Green Lake School District, says his school has felt it.
We've reduced administrative staff, we've reduced clerical staff, we've reduced custodial staff. We're getting smaller, but how small do you get before you don't exist?
But there are a lot of factors that go into budgets like Green Lake's, some of which have little to do with who's governor. And this is why measuring Walker's small government promise is so tough. But if you boil down state government to factors Walker can control, and you don't adjust for inflation, you see a government that's growing. The number of general fund state employee positions has inched up under Walker, and the nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau says actual spending in the general fund is projected to be almost 10% higher at the end of this fiscal year than it was in Jim Doyle's last budget. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
We'll continue that series tomorrow with a look at the governor's campaign statements on job creation. The story that dominated political news last week was the surprise defeat of House Majority Leader Eric Cantor in a primary. His successor in that leadership role, Kevin McCarthy, was selected earlier today. Parts of the Tea Party movement around the country supported his successful primary challenger, David Brad.
The Tea Party is one of the latest versions of a long history of populist political movements in the U.S., and our resident Central Time historian is back with us to take a look into that history behind today's news.
Jonathan Pollack is in the studio with us. He's a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. He joins us each month to put the latest news in historical context. John, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Rob. Nice to be back.
Well, before we talk about the past and present, let's get a definition in here. What do we mean when we talk about populism in American politics?
Well, that's a great question to start off with. Populism is one of those terms that's kind of malleable, but in general, it's a movement of people against elites. It's kind of an anti-elitist movement. And then from there, if you say, okay, so what kind of elites and what are the aspects of the movement, that's kind of changed over time. Mm. In general, if we want to have a big conversation, though, it's kind of it's the little guy versus the big guy. And then you can expand that to looking at business. You can expand it to looking at the role of the state governments or local governments versus the federal government. Economics, there are all kinds of ways that populism comes in. But generally, it's the same root. It's like the people. It's like the people are rising up. And it's a cool term because it transcends traditional political labels that different historians will argue that populism is it's a left-wing movement, it's a right-wing movement, and it kind of has elements of both in it through most of its history.
Well, before we dig back into the history, let's look at how it looks today. And you mentioned it kind of straddles both sides of the political fence. How does that play out now?
Okay, so for instance, in the Dave Brat Eric Cantor contest that you talked about at the beginning of this segment, so in that case, Brat was called some people called him a populist mm-hmm. because he criticized Cantor for being out of touch with his district, that he was too concerned with making a name for himself, too concerned with sort of playing with the fat cats in Washington and so forth, and not attentive to the needs of his constituents back in Virginia. And at the same time, on the other end of the political spectrum, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is often categorized as a populist because she's a bankruptcy attorney by training. And so she's been really active in trying to change federal policy on student loans. She's kept a sharp eye on the mortgage industry and so forth. And so she also has been described as a more populist Democratic politician than, say, Hillary Clinton.
Is part of populism, though, not just somebody making the case for the people, but trying to help generate a political movement by the people?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's it's kind of one of the contradictions of populism, I guess, that it kind of presents itself as this leaderless movement of just independently a bunch of people are upset about conditions in their area and they want to do something about it. But also over time, populist leaders have kind of, you know, many populist leaders have been sort of like charismatic leaders who wind up wielding a great deal of power. And in many ways, many populist leaders throughout history, once you get past the rhetoric and you look at where they actually came from and what they actually did and how they affected the scope of party politics in their era, it comes out as well that the people's interests beyond rhetoric weren't exactly met, and kind of the same people who were in charge before this populist movement remained so afterwards.
Well, let's start digging into the history. Where do you want to start in American history with a big populist movement that made a difference in the political scene?
Well, I think one of the first movements, and I don't believe this was really called populist at the time, mm-hmm. it was a term kind of ascribed by historians looking back at it, was really Andrew Jackson's presidency in the run-up to the 1828 elections, that Jackson presented himself very much as a man of the people. Jackson opened up his inaugural party to just the public. And
they kind of trashed the place.
They completely trashed the place. Yeah, they got loaded on something called orange punch. I mean, we're not sure what's in it. And so he had that image, you know, that he was this hard drinking frontier guy mm-hmm. who brought people like him into Washington. And in fact, what Jackson kind of did, a big part of his platform was really uniting white settlers against Native Americans. That I'd say was one of his big contributions to American politics in that era. But at the same time, in real life, Jackson was a slave owner. He owned hundreds of slaves. He had this huge plantation in Tennessee. And so in that sense was not from the same background as the people he purported to be part of. So Jackson, I think, is kind of this early populist figure.
And he's kind of reacting to, I mean, the nation was not founded necessarily on populist lines. There was an idea that there should be a lot of advantage to the elite in a lot of the ways the federal government was set up. And Jackson was kind of a reaction to that in part, right?
Yeah, Jackson was a reaction to that. And he was also a reaction to urban interests. And I think this is also another component that frequently pops up in populism, that populism often presents itself as a movement of people from rural areas and small towns who were lining up against people coming out of the cities. In that sense, in a you could even argue the roots of populism go as far back as Thomas Jefferson, who kind of idealized the small farmer and so forth. But that's another component of populism. And Jackson was a Westerner, and presidents before him had come from Massachusetts, had come from more urban areas of Virginia at that time. So in that sense, that kind of adds to his name as a populist.
And so two running themes, you say, often rural-based, hostile to elites and cities, and then race. You started to touch on that with Andrew Jackson. Do you see that as a common recurring theme in populism?
It is something that pops up all the time. I'm not going to say that it always has to be there, but as with the other two, it's one of those things that comes up quite a bit. So, for example, if we go, I already mentioned about Jackson and his Native American policy. If you move forward a couple of generations to the 1880s and 1890s, the populist movement of that era was initially kind of across racial boundaries. There were black populists, there were white populists. However, in southern states, white populists found they couldn't win elections if they didn't pander to racism. So Tom Watson, for example, who came out of the South, was this leading Southern populist out of Georgia, and he turned very quickly, and he became extremely racist, virulently racist. So in that sense, populists of Watson's generation, instead of kind of scapegoating Native Americans and trying to channel white anger toward them, channeled the same anger toward blacks toward the end of the post-Reconstruction era leading up to the 20th century.
We're looking at the history of populism in the United States with our resident Central Time historian, Jonathan Pollack. He's a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College.
And you can join in the conversation, too. How do you see populism? Is it a positive force in American politics and history, or do you see it as more of a downside? And what do you think about the populism of American history? How does it relate to populism we might be seeing today? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us, talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation about populism in American history with Jonathan Pollack, history instructor at Madison Area Technical College.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Your thoughts, questions, observations about this idea of populism through American history. 800-642-1234. We'll pick up with William Jennings Bryan in just a minute, John, but let's bring on Matt in La Crosse. Matt, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. I listened to a radio program that actually had a caller from Virginia talk about Eric Cantor's losing his primary to the David Brandt guy. And the thing is, that what you brought up, Jonathan, was the fact that he did lose based on the fact that Eric Cantor did lose based with the constituency, didn't show up to town hall meetings, sent staff members, and said that as a representative of the people, you actually have to show up and meet with the people, and that's exactly why he lost. And then I'm a little concerned about where you're going with the populism on the racial topic, because a lot of times I hear Tea Party are racist and all this other stuff, and it's like furthest thing from the truth, and I'm just hoping that conversation doesn't go there. I'm a conservative, and I'm the least thing from a racist whatsoever, so I'm really hoping that that's not going to get brought up in discussion. I did hear something like Eric Cantor is like Jewish or something like that, and that was the reason for him losing, and I just wanted to make sure that conversation does not go there, because
Matt, thanks a lot. Thanks for calling, Matt. I want to bring John in on that, on the two points you brought up.
Yeah, so kind of going in reverse order. When I talked about race and the populists, I mentioned, and this was in line with the other issues that populists take position on. The race is something that comes up often, but is not necessarily always there. And it's something that populists will change their mind on. I mean, before he was a racist, Tom Watson was a populist. He folded that in later on. We can look at other – if we get into the 20th century and we talk about populism in more detail, there are other areas where there are populist movements where the race issue doesn't really come up. Having said that, though, I mean, I couldn't – as one of my big research areas is the American Jewish experience, I couldn't help but notice that one of the similarities between like populists of the late 19th century, one of the things they talked about was they were quite anti-Semitic. When they talked about the cities, they identified Jews with the cities and so forth, and quite a bit of the stuff they put out was out there. And so I've seen there are a couple of things that are speculating about Cantor, and I'm not sure that's the case there. I mean, he had deep Virginia roots. His parents were political activists in the Richmond area where he grew up and went on to represent. But there is that sort of, you know, line that could conceivably be crossed if people keep coming up with this, if Cantor, you know, in some ways reasserts himself in regional politics in that part of Virginia, of an identification between Jews and urban areas and so forth. And in a scheme of things where urban areas are evil and the rural areas are good, by that transitive property, therefore, Jews are part of that evil. At the same time, yeah, the caller is exactly right. There are, you know, in the couple of weeks, week and a half, since that election, lots of factors have come up. It's also interesting that constituent service is a big part of it. I mean, just, you know, answering constituents' phone calls, treating with respect, as the caller pointed out, coming to things, that also seems to have a big part of it. I mean, I think the populist angle, though, that's a big part of Bratt's campaign, and it's the kind of thing that politicians in other parts of the country seem to be seizing on and kind of writing about how politicians should be aware of this, that they should continue to run against Washington and against bigness and so forth. And so, therefore, there is sort of a populist tie-in beyond just sort of keeping track of your constituents.
Well, I want to hit a couple more big populist points in American history. I mentioned William Jennings Bryan. I think of him as the big populist, but I don't know as much as I should about him beyond that.
Yeah. So, okay. So Bryan's a great example. So Bryan was not known for his pronouncements on race. And off the top of my head here, not having done extensive William Jennings Bryan's research, I'm not sure what it was. Bryan was an example actually of sort of in the vein of Andrew Jackson before him, of somebody who started out as this kind of man of the people and really built like this movement around him, became this very charismatic leader. Bryan's big issue was really economics. He was for free silver, which would allow... Let me see if I can get the economics straight. It would be an inflationary policy which would help people who were in debt, because farmers the 1890s had to take on huge amounts of debt to buy seed, to buy equipment, and so forth in advance of the growing season, and then try to repay their debts when the season was done. And of course, if you don't have a good growing season, then you're racking up debt. So that's the constituency that Bryan was talking about. And perhaps I think Bryan's example also brings in another kind of recurring theme in populism that's not entirely consistent, because it wasn't a big deal for Andrew Jackson, for instance, but it is arguably a big deal for populists in the present: anti-debt. That one of the organizing issues of populism, and again, it's not perfectly consistent because populism is a really squishy word, that debt is often a part of it, that politicians running on opposing debt and fighting debt and so forth. If you're in favor of that, you might be a populist.
Was that a theme picked up in the Depression era?
Debt was not as much a theme there. I mean, the populists I'm thinking of there, in some ways, no, it wasn't related to debt exactly. I mean, some of the prominent populists in the Depression era were more concerned with the disparities between wealth and poverty. When you look at like Huey Long, the governor and eventually senator from Louisiana, he created the Share the Wealth movement that was a huge taxation on wealth in Louisiana and a big expansion of public works and hospitals and things in that line. You've got Francis Townsend, who proposed an old age pension plan before Social Security. So you've got populists there who are organizing on a bunch of different issues. Beyond debt, neither of them, Long's racial record is really conflicted. People will say, yeah, Long was racist. And people say, no, he actually was anti-racist. And Townsend, to the best of my knowledge, had very few black supporters. So race was kind of tangential again. So yeah, so populism again. They were still talking about the little guy. There was widespread concern in the 1930s about older people who had outspent they'd lost their savings in the stock market mm-hmm. crash. They had done everything right, and now they were destitute, and that was a problem. Which again it's a separate problem from debt. Really, they weren't destitute because they had bought themselves things they couldn't afford. They had played by the rules, and still they lost their assets.
Before we're done, just one general question. Do economic crises tend to be a boost for populist ideas, populist thinking?
Yeah, I'd say that's one of the things that's really consistent, that that it's an economic movement, that it's an economic crisis that spurs populism. I mean, if you look at times in prosperity in the United States, so let's say the 1950s, there's not really a populist movement. You know, we could probably, if we looked real hard, we could find movements that had some kind of populist tone to them, kind of on the fringes of American politics. You could say the Communist Party of the United States arguably had this populist strand to it, and the John Birch Society arguably had a populist strand to it. But those are tiny. Those are organizations where there's like more FBI agents in there than paid up members. So in prosperous periods, no, populism sort of shrinks away. When the economy falters or when it doesn't recover, that's what brings them out.
John, thanks so much. Could talk for a lot more about this. Thanks for coming up again.
Thank you, Rob.
That was Jonathan Pollack, history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. He joins us each month as our resident historian to just give us the historical background behind what's in the news today.
It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell in today for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a world of accordions has a home here in Wisconsin. We'll pay a visit to the Superior-based museum.
First, on May 27th of this year, immigration agents in Milwaukee conducted a raid across immigrant neighborhoods in the city, detaining 21 people.
The Department of Homeland Security said the raid was aimed at breaking up street gangs and arresting illegal immigrants with serious criminal records. This is part of an ongoing operation in which 200 immigrants have been identified.
Manuel Lopez was one of the people detained. His family, along with a handful of others, protested outside of Milwaukee's Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office this morning, asking for his release.
Christine Newman-Ortiz is executive director of Voces de la Frontera. She joined that protest. She joins us now to talk about it. Christine, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
And we have Manuel Lopez's daughter on our other line, Destiny Lopez. Destiny, hello.
Hi.
So, Christine, let's start with you picking up the story on May 27th. What prompted the arrests of these undocumented immigrants in Milwaukee?
Well, we know that over the last couple of years that immigration has at times will move beyond its more individualized detentions, which often occur at people's homes. We've seen it increase, as folks know, in the courtrooms in Wisconsin. And but then at times they do kind of a larger sweep, and this was one of those. And over the years, we've always known that when they do these sweeps, they put out their public press releases and really label people as hardened criminals. And aren't we all, you know, safer that they're all behind bars, you know, and that kind of characterization and mischaracterization. And so one of the benefits that Voces has is that it's a resource for families who've been impacted by deportations to come and seek help. And once we have families who come, and half of those families of the 21 we've had contact with, we're able to really know the facts and really make that public and expose a lot of the justifications. Because what's really driving this is that, Congress has a mandate that immigration has to detain 34,000 immigrants a day to fill beds, detention beds. So in terms of the priorities around public safety are not being respected, because they have this arbitrary mandate that if they want to keep receiving federal dollars, they have to go do this. And so this last dragnet really exemplifies again some of the criminalization of immigrants that we're seeing. So in the case of like this last one, five of those cases, the 21 immigration said were gang associated. The other 16 were immigrant violations. But even in the cases where they say gang association, you have folks who, you know, like in two of those cases, we know, you know, it went back to when the person was a young person, like 13, 14 years old, and this was like 14, 17 years ago, and that individual turned their lives around. They're, you know, working adults now, loving fathers, husbands, and are providing honorably for their family. And so we've saw in this last round a lot of this kind of retroactive searching to take people, and this kind of activity doesn't provide any public safety at all. It undermines public safety.
Christine, I just wanted to ask, since our time is limited, what was the goal of this morning's protest?
It was to shut down Immigration Customs Enforcement and to really send a message that, you know, here they are making these announcements where you have people who have had no criminal records, you know, or people who represent no threat whatsoever, who are being picked up, and they're destroying families and having a huge impact, not just on the family, but on the community. And that, you know, our message is that, you know, to President Obama, that if he's not going to shut down these ICE operations, then the families and the community are. And this is a movement across the country to really call on him to use his executive authority to stop these deportations and provide even a temporary form of legalization till we can actually get the kind of reform we've been waiting for so long.
Christine, before we go to his daughter, can you tell us Manuel Lopez's story?
Manuel Lopez is one of those examples of a good family man who, you know, who is really a role model. I mean, he's someone who in the past did have a drug charge, and when he was a young guy, this is more than 10 years ago, and who paid his dues and learned his lessons and turned his life around. You're talking about something that a charge that happened when he was a young guy 10 years ago, and he is one of, you know, his niece, his brother, his daughter, both Destiny and her cousin are 11 years old. I mean, they have a loving family, and he's a good provider, and he's someone who's actually a role model because he's someone who showed how, you know, you can make mistakes in life and turn your life around. And that's the person who's wrongly being labeled, and they are destroying a family, both economically, emotionally, and really they're denying this person his freedom. I mean, he is still being held in detention, and he's a case, as others around the country that we believe are being, don't represent any kind of threat and whose deportation cases should be closed. And these are people who should be reunited with their family because they don't represent any kind of priority. And in fact, all they do is create more fear within the community to work with law enforcement.
And Christine, we've got Manuel's daughter, Destiny Lopez, on the line. Destiny, were you there when your dad was arrested?
Yes, I was there. It was the day after Memorial Day, and he was taking us to school, and they came and he took him in front of all of us.
And have you heard from him since he was arrested?
Yes, I have. We have phone communication, but we have to pay like $10 a minute just to talk to him. And well, if we go visit, it's like through a glass door. You can't even touch him or hug him at all.
And what is the immigration status of the rest of his family?
We're all residents. We are, my grandparents are citizens, and, you know, we're just trying to make a living here. You know, is that wrong for us to come here and, you know, to have a better life, to provide for our family?
Were you at the protest this morning, Destiny?
Yes, I was. I was there, to support and to have justice.
And what do you hope people who hear about your protest, what do you want them to take away? What do you want them to know?
I want them to know that, you know, immigration isn't crime, that we all deserve to be happy and united, to provide for our families, and, you know, that basically immigration isn't wrong at all. You know, whether you're trying to bring a case or, you know, the color of our skin or whatever it is, we all deserve to be united and be together equally.
Christine, a lot of people might feel sympathy for Manuel and Destiny and the whole family, but say he came here knowingly against United States law and should be subject to the consequences of that. What do you say, Christine?
Well, first of all, being undocumented is not a crime. It's a civil infraction. And I think there's a greater law, too, when you think about this country. And we can't forget that because it's not that many generations ago. This country has been built by generations of immigrants. And the American dream is about coming to the United States and trying to build a better life for yourself. These are people who are contributing positively. I mean, people who are contributing to our tax base. They're obviously working in many cases. You have people who've been here, like the parents of the Dreamers, who just recently were able to get temporary legal status. You know, their parents have been here for over 20 years. You know, they're seamstresses, they're janitors. We benefit from their labor. And I think it's right. We have a system that is dysfunctional, that it's discriminatory, that's very cruel. And I think, you know, what the crisis that we're in is that for so many years now, we've been fighting, certainly Voces has been fighting for over 10 years now for immigration reform. And though I know we are going to get there because the votes are there, and I think ultimately, inevitably, we're going to get there, but especially the closer we get to presidential elections, and the Latino vote is, you know, very, very key. But in the meantime, we have a deportation machinery that has been set up, that set up under Bush, was expanded under Obama, and, you know, that has these arbitrary quotas and has a system that actually criminalizes people that in no sense of the word are any kind of threat. They're, in fact, they're people who are contributing positively. We don't gain by instilling fear in the community. We don't gain anything by leaving what is often the case, women who then the head of household who provided is now gone, and leaving women in many cases now to try to find where are they going to pay the bills. I mean, that's what Voces does, like have an emergency fund to, in whatever modest way we can, try to provide some emotional and financial support.
We'll leave it there for now. Thanks to Christine Newman-Ortiz, Executive Director of Voces de la Frontera, and to Destiny Lopez, daughter of Manuel Lopez, who was detained during a raid in late May. Time now for Curious Wisconsin, where we highlight interesting, unusual, and unique people and places around the state of Wisconsin.
In this edition, we go to Superior to visit a musical museum called A World of Accordions. It features over 1,300 accordions and related instruments and exhibits devoted to musicians and bands which featured the accordion.
Helmy Harrington is the owner and curator of A World of Accordions in Superior. Helmy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for allowing me to be part of this program.
Well, what will we see when we walk into the World of Accordions Museum?
Well, first you should know that we're not only a local, but also a national and in many ways a world treasure. We are the single best accordion museum collection of instruments and their taxonomy in history anywhere. But you will see a breathtaking, eye-appeal, candy-like selection of 1,300 accordions on display. There are more in the building for varying displays, but you'll see all kinds of colors and designs, many more types of keyboard structures than anybody presumes is part of the family.
You mentioned the taxonomy. How much variety is there in the way accordions are designed and put together?
They were invented in 1829 by patent of Cyril Damian in Vienna. The instrument spread like wildfires throughout the world, and every country and every small place redeveloped, redesigned them to suit their own musical needs. So there are hundreds and hundreds of variations. No one has yet put together a complete taxonomy, and I've personally been working on one for 20 years, and it's still not complete.
Wow. And you've also got exhibits and tributes to a number of accordionists and bands that feature the accordion. Can you tell us about a couple of them?
Absolutely. Well, the accordion is always popular throughout the world. It's one of the main distributors of folk music, legends, texts, body rhythms, dances, and traditions everywhere. So we have folk interests that are particularly strong since the 1980s, in which there was a rejuvenation of nostalgia throughout the United States. We have lots of pop music that results through and from that. So garage accordionists or garage bands add an accordion or a concertina, at least to the 75% of all, I am told. There are lots of rock and roll or pop bands that use them for periodic sound effects. And, of course, the instrument is a concert instrument, so there are a number of not only entertainment and virtuoso groups, but very serious artistic performers that deal with the original repertory of the instrument, which is every bit as important to the world as Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms.
It's a really versatile instrument. It's kind of like a guitar in a way that it's portable. It can be a solo accompaniment to somebody singing, and it works really well with a band, too.
Well, this is true.
Now, tell us a little more about the museum. How long have you been there?
We have the music was a museum was established about 25 years ago. We were first in Duluth, and we've been in Superior, Wisconsin for the last 12-plus years. The museum comprises not only the collection of accordions, but also a fabulous concert hall in which they are sounded and which has attracted performers from all over the world. We have library rooms that deal with reference materials and constructions of the instrument's history. We have about 1 million pieces of music that are accordion-related. For all of the members of the accordion family, we have catalogs, we have historic descriptions, we have reference materials, and we have the American Accordionist Association's archival collection, so that there is a presence in our building where people can view the social history of this major organization. Wow. We also have the Defner Legacy. We have some very specialized collections by.
So you mentioned that you get musicians from all over the world. You also get researchers coming in to check out all those materials.
Thank you for asking. Yes, we've had at least 24 worldwide. We get national people and about 24 books or DVD documentaries have resulted from at least part of the studies that take place here.
Now, you are obviously someone who loves the accordion. What led you to that?
My mother and I emigrated from Germany after World War II, and it was how my mother made a living for us in Texas. She studied at the world's best accordion school and then made a living for our small family in Texas. I was interested in what she did, so even as a small child, was influenced by the accordion. I used the accordion to support myself all the way through 14 years of college. But by the time I was a teenager, my eyes went to a different direction, and I became a concert pianist, after which, well, in addition to which, I earned a PhD in musicology. So nowadays, people don't argue too much about truth in references, but certainly the passion for music has been part of my life. And the knowledge of good and bad is present in that. Certainly also the love of making the music, which has spurred everything I've ever done.
With all the time you put into the museum, do you still have time to play and perform and teach music?
I have about 60 students a week.
Really? Wow.
In two locations, 200 miles apart. I play regularly in concerts and have done so with the symphony as well as in my own private environment here and elsewhere, as well as in national venues. So, yes, the love of making the music is what spurs and keeps it alive in my heart.
And if we visit World of Accordions, would we be able to talk you into doing a performance in the in your music hall there?
Oh, I wish you would. Yes, put me to the test. You see, I play all of the members of the accordion family, and so when I put on a demonstration, I'll play that which is folk, virtuoso, specific ethnic, like French musettes, as well as concert material and the transcriptions from the classics like Bach fugues or original music that was written for the accordion. Yes, I do all of it.
How important is the accordion as part of our cultural heritage here in Wisconsin in particular?
I think Wisconsin has a special basis for love in the instrument. We have many great performers that have established their lifespans here. I mean, Frankie Yankovic is certainly one. We have so many specific ethnic groups that have loved and promoted the accordion. I think we're in a very fortuitous place. But also, Wisconsin is in the center of the nation. There is no more perfect place to have some activity or important interest like we have for the accordion.
I've seen, it seems like, more and more people getting into accordions or the accordion family. I know my brother has picked up the concertina recently. Are we in the midst of an accordion renaissance?
Well, I'd like to say that there has never been a major decline because, you see, I've been in the accordion studio and business activities all my life, and it's always been big and important in my world. But I do think that there's truth to that. There are more people buying more instruments, more companies coming into existence, more distribution issues that seem to go not only nationwide but worldwide.
Helmy,
so the groundswell is there again.
Helmy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ferret. I love the opportunity.
That was Helmy Harrington. She's curator of A World of Accordions Museum in Superior.